September is any guide. In Kiev, there's been one explosion after another caused by mines. The town has been burning for 8 days already, and the Jews have done it all. So all Jews between 14 and 60 have been shot, and the Jewish women will be shot too. Otherwise, there'll be no end to it. The army also readily colluded in mass killings by the order police. Another immense mass killing, in which 15,000 Jews were murdered in Kharkov in December, was the work of a company of Police Battalion 314. In the Crimea, 30 Corps, commanded by General Hans von Zalmut, allowed Einsatzgruppen D to murder the peninsula's Jews en masse, while declaring that its Sonderkommandos were proceeding harshly in the interests of security. Barely any army commands opposed the massacres taking place in their midst. Lieutenant General Kurt Agricola, commander of the Second Army's rear area from December 1941, tried to prevent Jews in his jurisdiction from being shot by the SS. Agricola probably took this strong moral stand because he was married to a Jewish woman, who spent the war in exile in South America and was reunited with him on his release from Soviet captivity in 1955. The revulsion felt by some officers, such as Colonel Henning von Tresco on Field Marshal von Bock's staff at Army Group Center, was less public but more profound in its consequences. Their experience of the mass murder of Jewish men, women, and children seems to have played a role in their decision to begin plotting actively to overthrow the Nazi regime by assassinating Hitler himself. Tresco later wrote of the extermination of tens of thousands of Jews in the most horrible way. More often, senior rear commanders might oppose the killings, but only in a qualified manner. In doing so, they betrayed their own national conservative brand of anti-Semitism. For instance, General of Infantry Franz von Rock, commander of the Army Group North rear area, protested, albeit unsuccessfully, about the mass shooting of Jews, but his preferred moderate alternative, like Field Marshal von Leibs, was to sterilize all male Jews. Some officers, well aware of what murdering all Soviet Jews, irrespective of age or gender, amounted to, were anxious to preserve a facade of decency. They may also have been pondering the possibility that Germany would lose the war. Other commanders still might choose to remain completely silent, but also record their revulsion, or at least discomfort, in their personal writings and correspondence. Rear area commanders generally came from older age groups. Because they had experienced pre-Nazi society and retained some older conservative values, they were generally less Nazified than their younger colleagues. But while this may have led many to disapprove of, or indeed abhor, the killings, it did not generally lead them into open opposition. Rear area units also had more blood on their hands than their frontline comrades when it came to targeting Jews in the army's anti-partisan operations. Here, however, was a particularly blurred line between front and rear, for numerous frontline units were also temporarily assigned to anti-partisan duty. Senior commanders rarely displayed qualms about targeting Jews as reprisal victims. After all, army directives and army propaganda usually depicted Jews as inciters of and accomplices to partisan action, or labeled Jews themselves as partisans. On this score, some units did not just follow the increasingly extreme security directives emanating from on high, but actually outdid them. Thus, while it was rare, though not unheard of, for army units to carry out or participate directly in mass executions in which over 100 Jews were killed, the 25th Infantry Division exceeded the OKW's instructions to shoot 100 hostages for every German killed by irregular actions. Instead, it reported that, in agreement with the Ostkommandantur, as punishment for the shooting of one officer in the Jewish quarter, 150 Jews were summarily shot and the housing sector blown to pieces. Of the three commanders of the Army Group rear areas, Army Group Center's General von Schenkendorf held most strongly to the view that Jews were a security threat and used SS anti-partisan measures as a pointer for his own men. Schenkendorf arranged the Army SS conference at Mogilev on 24 September, which drilled the Jew equals partisan mantra into all who participated. Because of northern Russia's relatively small Jewish population, Army Group North's security campaign claimed relatively few Jewish lives. It was a different story with the more southerly army groups. Belarus saw the army's most direct involvement in the mass murder of Soviet Jews. It had not only a sizable Jewish population, but also a dearth of anti-Semitic nationalists whom the Germans might have recruited as auxiliaries. It therefore fell to the army to assume a more prominent role in annihilating the region's Jewish communities. In the civilian-administered General Commissariat of White Ruthenia, part of the new Reich Commissariat Ostland, army units were directly responsible for the murder of Jews on a particularly grand scale. The 707th Infantry Division was an extremely substandard division of the 15th Wave that found itself in temporary overall charge of all security operations in the General Commissariat when Einsatzgruppe B moved further eastwards in mid-August. During October and November, the fanatical Nazis at the division's head, its commander, General von Bechtolsheim, and its operations officer, Colonel von der Osten, ordered the division's own regiments to cleanse the countryside of Jews and communists in the name of security, and commanded the 707th Subordinate Order Police Units to exterminate the ghettoized Jews in the territory. Von der Osten proclaimed, "The Jews, the spiritual leaders and carriers of Bolshevism and the communist idea, are our mortal enemy. They are to be exterminated." Not all the 707th's officers were as murderously disposed as divisional command. Colonel Karl Andrian, commander of the 747th Infantry Regiment, was happy to use Jews as hostages, but drew the line at general massacre, and kept his head in the sand over the killings perpetrated by the 707th's order police units. But Colonel Josef Pausinger, who commanded the 727th Infantry Regiment, had no such qualms. The 707th and its subordinate units went on to kill over 10,000 individuals during October and November, the vast majority of whom were Jews. A recent in-depth study, which extensively utilizes post-war testimonies from federal German investigations, has revealed much about the way in which German army units in Belarus, but particularly those of the 707th Infantry Division, became active components of the machinery of mass murder. The soldiers who were involved were rarely homicidal anti-Semites to start with. The men of the 707th in particular were too old to have undergone the especially extensive anti-Semitic conditioning to which their younger comrades had been subjected from school through the Hitler Youth, the RAD, and then the army. Yet they hailed from a society that possessed deep undercurrents of anti-Semitism from before 1933. And in which Nazi propaganda had largely succeeded in persuading the population that Jews were a social problem demanding a solution. Then, when the men commenced military service, the army itself got to work, seeking to ingrain within them a combination of Nazi ideology and ruthlessly utilitarian military thinking, and to reward the radical, violent action for which their conditioning had prepared them. Given how socially diverse the army's enormous rank and file were, the army leadership could not realistically expect to indoctrinate all of them with equal thoroughness. Nevertheless, considering that so many soldiers expressed anti-Semitic sentiments in their letters, it seems that plenty were indeed receptive to extreme anti-Semitic conditioning. A further sign of this is that many senior field commanders had to issue warnings that witnessing or participating in mass executions might affect the troops' discipline. For instance, Field Marshal von Rundstedt expressed no moral objection to the killings, but he did forbid his troops to take matters into their own hands, participate in the excesses of the Ukrainian population against the Jews, or watch or photograph the measures being taken by the Sonderkommandos. Soldiers may have sought to attend executions primarily out of morbid curiosity, but ingrained anti-Semitism would have helped to make the notion morally acceptable to them. The vast majority of officers in the 707th unit smoothly implemented murderous anti-Semitic directives, if not always with the same zeal as one another. The vast majority of their men complied, albeit reluctantly in numerous cases, even if they had the option not to. A few individuals, including one company commander on behalf of his unit, refused to participate in mass killing directly, though none was punished significantly. So much for veterans' post-war exculpatory claims that refusing orders would have brought fearful consequences. A few soldiers, for personal or moral reasons one can only speculate upon, found it within themselves to help Jews in some way or other. For instance, some of the men of the 727th Infantry Regiment's 7th Company supplied false work permits to Jews. This was a relatively safe way of helping them evade a massacre of Jews who were deemed to have no economic value. Some soldiers used Jewish women, in direct contravention of Nazi racial laws, as a sexual outlet, but not all their relations with Jewish women were coercive. However, hardly any individual refused to participate in guard duty, cordons, or other forms of assistance to killing operations. The 707th's case also shows how individual junior officers had a hand in shaping their men's conduct. Of all the 707th Infantry Regiment's companies, the 6th Company had a particularly appalling record when it came to killing or maltreating Jews. Like all the regiment's companies, it was of a poor standard, overaged, undertrained, and under-equipped. The 707th as a whole was also overstretched. It was responsible for administering an area the size of Wales. The 6th Company may therefore have been killing Jews partly in order to compensate for its woeful condition, but it also had a particularly fanatical company commander. Furthermore, its example shows how the longer a unit was exposed to mass killings, the more direct and more systematic its own involvement could then become. Very early on in the Eastern Campaign, the 6th Company participated in a massacre of Jews in Slonim, carried out by the SS and Lithuanian nationalists. Its men were ordered not to carry out the execution, but to set it up by cordoning off the area and assembling the Jews. Signs that the company's soldiers were enjoying their work come from eyewitness accounts claiming that the men manhandled the Jews roughly on their way to the execution site, and that 6 of them volunteered to take part in the actual shootings. Later, the whole company diligently went about hunting down Jews who had managed to evade the execution. Of the 2.4 million Soviet Jews whom the Nazis murdered during the Second World War, between 450,000 and 500,000 were killed within the German army-administered zone in the Soviet Union, almost all during the last 6 months of 1941. Half that figure was killed in the Ukraine. Open protest or resistance from just a few senior commanders might have encouraged more officers further down the command chain to follow suit. It will never be known whether and how far such a stand might have slowed, limited, or even prevented the escalation to mass murder. Field Marshal von Bock was the only senior commander who openly protested during the campaign, and his main concern was to distance the army from what was happening rather than prevent it altogether. Senior commanders, hailing from a national conservative background, generally harbored anti-Semitic views already, and the character of the war against the Soviet Union hardened their anti-Semitism as they came to associate Jews with Bolshevism ever more strongly. They also widely believed that Jews were responsible for the worsening security situation in the occupied rear, and also, as their own troops' food supply situation worsened, that killing Jews was a quick means of closing surplus mouths. This was the corrupted level to which senior commanders' increasingly unconditional support for National Socialism had now brought them. On the front line, as summer turned to autumn, the environment itself turned increasingly against the Germans. Their advance now faced the mud of the autumn Rasputitsa, as heavy rains transformed the landscape. For the 25th Infantry Division, the weather worsened as early as 11 September. Lance Corporal Hans S. wrote, "The roads are in a crazy state. We can happily count on our trucks, and yet such a journey is now like a mad funfair ride." On 9 November, 2nd Lieutenant Fritz K. of the 4th Mountain Division described how the horses in his division were wading up to their stomachs in mud. The environment then was not so much delaying the German advance as miring it. Troops suffering from these conditions, as well as from mounting losses and the physical and mental strain of 4 months virtually constant campaigning, were hardly going to feel they were on the cusp of victory. On 2 October, the 4th Mountain Division bemoaned the loss of many of its best commanders, platoon leaders, section leaders, and specialist troops. It counted a shortfall of 130 officers, 180 NCOs, and 1,800 troops, and this after the addition of 2 new march battalions. By 22 November, its troops were suffering from a litany of physical complaints, including cold-related conditions, lung infections, angina, diphtheria, scarlet fever, and 20 cases of first to second degree freezing. Cases of jaundice were particularly widespread. This did not mean, however, that the army was breaking down. The 25th Infantry Division, for one, reported that the health of its troops was faring reasonably well. Nevertheless, by the end of November, the Eastern Army was short of 340,000 men. By autumn, senior field commanders feared for their men's discipline and morale, and they had good reason if the 198th Infantry Division's case is any guide. On 1 November, the divisional commander complained of a heap of violations against enforced and established orders, and also against orders that I myself particularly decreed, in order to ensure the discipline and good reputation of the 198th Infantry Division, I will not tolerate this. 9 Army Corps declared on 5 September, hard but worthwhile tasks stand before all commanders and all officers who are real men. Whoever up until now was hard, strong, and self-sacrificing will not recoil when he has to behave harder still. It also declared that the idea of a Heimatschuss, a wound serious enough to warrant sending a soldier home without being crippling, is not one that we want to see resurrected in this war. One of the more successfully debilitating measures the Soviets were employing was scorched earth. Friedrich M. of the 73rd Infantry Division, advancing through the southern Ukraine, described the city of Klysyny as a picture of gruesome destruction both on and off the streets. The shops burned out, the upper stories collapsed, houses in complete ruins. The fire had burned out everything down to the cellars, and today, 7 days after we took the town, the blaze was still hitting us. The red beasts really got stuck in here. They had even poured crude oil on the streets to set fire to them and create a firewall to hinder the Germans. The water supply has been destroyed, and electricity works have been blown sky high. In the eastern Ukrainian town of Stalino, at the end of October, Senior Corporal Vili M. of the 4th Mountain Division described even more pertinently the impact scorched earth was having on the advancing Germans' ability to supply themselves. When the Russians pulled out, they destroyed and burned everything that could be of use to us. Until winter is over, there will be a great shortage, for many crops have been burned also. The Soviets were also employing propaganda increasingly dexterously. They recognized that there were vast swaths of the population, particularly in rural areas, who were largely immune to old-style communist propaganda. Instead, particularly when the Germans reached the soil of Russia proper, the Soviet propaganda machine employed nationalistic messages. Russian heroes of old, such as Alexander Nevsky and Ivan the Terrible, were invoked as examples for the Russian people. Soviet propaganda also employed vicious methods, matching Nazi rhetoric about the subhuman Slavs with incitements to immense violence against the German invader. When it came to generating hatred, of course, the Germans were giving Soviet propaganda ample material to work with. After the Germans' great operational victory at Kiev, with large concentrations of Soviet strength west of Moscow, Hitler ordered a major blow to destroy the Soviet forces before the capital, seize Moscow itself, and achieve a final strategic victory, not just an operational success bringing in lots of prisoners. Thus, on 2 October, Army Group Center launched Operation Typhoon. Army Group Center was once more the focus of German attention and resources. Just prior to Typhoon, it had been reinforced to the tune of 1.9 million men, 1,500 panzers, distributed across Panzer Groups 2, 3, and 4, and 1,000 aircraft. Facing it were 1.25 million Soviet troops of the Reserve, Western, and Bryansk fronts. Army Group Center had been too weak to capture Moscow after exhausting itself during and immediately following the Battle of Smolensk. However, the Red Army had also exhausted itself on the Central Front during that fighting, and had then concentrated much of its strength against the German offensive in the south. For these reasons, the Soviet defenses before Moscow were weaker in October, and Army Group Center's prospects correspondingly stronger than they had been in August. Typhoon's first goal was to destroy the Soviet forces around Vyazma and Bryansk. Again, Soviet intelligence failed to anticipate German intentions, and Red Army High Command also obliged the Germans by spreading Soviet forces too thinly. Furthermore, as well as trying to coordinate three army groups before Moscow, the Red Army was distracted by fear of further German attacks to the north and south. The encirclement that followed bagged a further 650,000 Red Army prisoners. Vyazma was a battle of annihilation, almost more awful than it is possible to imagine, wrote Major Hans Ahr of the 7th Panzer Division, serving under Panzer Group 3 on 15 October. The encircled masses tried to break out in all directions, had no supply, no munitions, no leadership anymore, and yet the deep-seated fear that all prisoners we take are shot drove them ever forward. From mid-October, the Germans were advancing on Moscow itself. However, with Hitler convinced that the Red Army really was finished this time, the Germans did not unleash their full strength on the capital until they had finished mopping up the Vyazma-Bryansk pocket. The Rasputitsa also stalled them. But most importantly, the ferocity of the fighting had again worn the Germans out. Among other things, General of Aviators Albert Kesselring, who commanded Air Fleet 2 during the battle, commented that the army's fully tracked vehicles, including tanks, were now barely serviceable. Guderian wrote that on 28 October, we were informed of Hitler's instructions that fast-moving units should seize the Oka bridges to the east of Serpukhov. There were no fast-moving units anymore. Hitler was living in a world of fantasy. The Luftwaffe was also under severe pressure during the Vyazma-Bryansk battles. Mud, increasing cold, and mounting supply problems all made it harder to maintain aircraft. It also had to operate from primitive dirt strips, while the Red Army's Air Force used permanent facilities near Moscow. For the Russian aircraft, the cloudy days are the best, wrote Corporal Josef B. of the 2nd Panzer Division on 26 November. For then there is little that our fighters and flak can do. The triumph of Vyazma-Bryansk aside, then, the autumn of 1941 saw the Germans' front-line advance grow ever more tortuous, and the prospects for decisive strategic success ever more tenuous. This knowledge had a marked effect upon senior front-line commanders. For the most part, senior commanders had been through years of conditioning that had laid the groundwork for their brutalization. They had been schooled in a culture of utilitarian military thinking. In some respects, their conservative worldview inured them to Nazism, but in other respects, anti-Semitism, anti-Slavism, and particularly anti-Bolshevism, it made them more susceptible. The general hubris that infected both the regime and the Wehrmacht following the fall of France made many commanders more susceptible still, especially if they had been rewarded professionally and financially in its wake. The criminal orders they had been issued, and had readily disseminated, had espoused all these values and fused them into an even starker blueprint for ruthlessness. Now, the bloody and ever more arduous conditions of the campaign itself hardened commanders' already obdurate proclivities further, and lent their conduct an even more brutal aspect. Acute food shortages, burgeoning partisan activity, and the onset of winter all provided the push for senior rear area commanders. The prospect of a protracted winter campaign further debilitating their troops' fighting power provided the push for senior frontline commanders. The forgotten army group in the north felt the effect earliest. By autumn, the main military operation with which Army Group North was concerned was against Leningrad. Halder, unlike Hitler, considered Leningrad unimportant. It was, in fact, a major industrial center and port. Capturing it would have effectively wrapped up the whole northern part of the Barbarossa campaign and released Army Group North units to other fronts. However, the drive of General Reinhardt's 41 Panzer Corps on Leningrad was delayed when Hitler ordered him to halt temporarily for fear that a continued advance would overstretch Army Group North's front. In any case, Reinhardt's corps lacked the infantry support needed to take the city swiftly. As for Leningrad itself, the Germans now had to settle down to a lengthy siege. As long as this was ongoing, there would be no end to the fighting in the north. Army Group North still wanted to take the city, but Hitler and the OKW ruled this out, citing the likely cost of the urban fighting that would be needed. Then, on 21 September, the OKW ruled that the city be sealed off, starved, and bombarded by artillery and the Luftwaffe. The survivors would eventually be interned in ghetto-like settlements in the rear area of the 18th Army, and the city razed to the ground. In the meantime, any attempt by the city to surrender was to be rejected. "What do we do with a city of 3.5 million people, which is just reliant on our supply bases?" General Wagner asked. "There is no room for sentiment there." Field Marshal von Leib wanted to allow Soviet civilians to pass into Soviet-held territory, but the OKW and the 18th Army's commander, General von Küchler, were opposed. Küchler also ordered his men to shoot any civilians from Leningrad who approached the German lines. Fearing for the morale of the men who would have to do the shooting, Leib eventually felt forced to lay mines around the city. The Germans would eventually only abandon the siege in January 1944, by which time at least 800,000 civilians, and perhaps well over a million, had starved to death. The fact that Küchler was a conservative-minded officer who had condemned SS killings in Poland makes his ruthlessness over Leningrad appear all the more remarkable. But as his decree to his troops before Barbarossa had shown, he too was shaped by that fusion of military and ideological thinking that increasingly permeated the senior officer corps. He was also under the brutalizing pressures of the campaign itself. The bitter memories of Britain's naval blockade of Germany during the First World War may also have hardened Küchler's attitude. And it was probably no coincidence that Leningrad and its surrounding region was situated in Great Russia, in the racial pecking order into which the Nazis arranged the Soviet Union's population, Great Russians were only one step up from Jews. Moreover, as the campaign became bogged down, some frontline commanders came to believe that troops needed fortifying for the longer, harder struggle that seemed to lie ahead. Blaming Jewish Bolsheviks for prolonging Soviet resistance at the front and in the rear might create a particularly potent hate figure with which to stoke the troops' ideological spirit further. It could also help to ensure smoother cooperation between Army and SS units over the latter's mushrooming campaign of mass murder against the Soviet Jews. All this certainly seems to have figured in Field Marshal von Reichenau's thinking when he issued a general order to his 6th Army in the Ukraine on 20 November. The soldier must have complete understanding for the necessity of the harsh but just atonement of Jewish subhumanity. This has the further goal of nipping in the bud rebellions in the rear of the Eastern Army, which, as experience shows, are always plotted by the Jews. Judging by the subsequent conduct of several of his subordinate units, Reichenau's decree had some effect. For instance, the 62nd Infantry Division's 119th Infantry Regiment shot 140 Jews and bandits, and the 75th Infantry Division claimed to have shot 1,131 people between 24 October and 21 December. Other 6th Army units used the freedom of action open to them to steer a somewhat more measured course. The pursuit and extermination of partisans and their accomplices is to be carried out with ruthless harshness, declared 51 Corps. It is unavoidable that sometimes the innocent will suffer also. But the Corps clearly did not want this to be a green light for unbridled savagery, for it also stated, "Despite all harshness, the punishment methods must not lead to general butchery and burning of villages by individual soldiers." By the same token, however, Reichenau used his own freedom of action to whip subordinates into line. Around the same time, he intervened against the 295th Infantry Division's Chief of Staff, Colonel Helmut Grosskurt, who had ordered a stay of execution of a number of Jewish orphans. Reichenau ordered, "The action that has already begun is to be carried out purposefully." Generals Hutt and von Manstein issued similar decrees to Reichenau, and, it seems, with similar motives. Hutt derided any compassion and weakness towards the population as misguided, and described Russia as not a European but an Asiatic state. "Each step in this unhappy, enslaved land teaches us this difference. Europe, and especially Germany, must be liberated forever from this pressure and from the destructive forces of Bolshevism." Manstein's order, issued to the troops of his 11th Army, asserted that the German soldier marches forth also as a carrier of a racial conception and as an avenger of all the atrocities which have been committed against him and the German people. Manstein was apparently well aware of the extent of Einsatzgruppe D's killings in the 11th Army's jurisdiction, and may well have been seeking to impress more emphatically upon his troops the view that the killings were a necessary military measure. Indeed, the 11th Army's own field gendarmerie and GFP units shot many Jews themselves in anti-partisan actions. Manstein may also have sought to persuade his troops to accept the surplus mouths argument for killing Jews. The single worst case of killing in the 11th Army's jurisdiction was to take place at Simferopol, where Einsatzgruppe D murdered 10,000 Jews between early December 1941 and mid-February 1942. The 11th Army's quartermaster directly intervened to get the executions sped up, and the surplus mouths motive certainly drove him, for he saw in the executions a means of preventing shortages of food and accommodation. However formidable Manstein's military qualities then, there was no moral quality to his stance over the war of annihilation against Judeo-Bolshevism. Divisional commands also placed increasing importance on ideological instruction. The 129th Infantry Division was just one formation that issued the pamphlet Ideological Instruction and Spiritual Care in the Army to its companies. It also recommended lecture themes for the troops, including the Nordic race, the German people, the German Reich, German living space, and National Socialism as a foundation. Maintaining the troops' morale became even more important with the prospect of a long campaign, but it needed more than ideological admonitions. Corporal Werner F. of the 12th Panzer Division, advancing on Tychwin in northern Russia, described such efforts in a letter of 10 November. On our journey yesterday along particularly bad routes, we saw nice signs, some of the scrawlings on which I can recount. It's a joy to be alive, or always look for the sun behind the clouds. There were other, more vulgar ones, which I won't recount. Pastoral care was crucial also. This was easier to provide for those formations already transitioning into static war. On 20 November, the 16th Army's intelligence section detailed its provisions for the troops' free time as well as their ideological political education. Newspapers, reading material, films, displays, and proper arrangements for leisure time, as well as sports and various kinds of competition, including photo competitions, literary, musical, crafts, art, technical, performing arts, chess, sport, and kitting out accommodations. Political and military instruction was provided by the Army's field newspaper. But though the 16th Army had the time to address its troops' pastoral care, there were many respects in which it lacked the resources. Its propaganda company had three film cars, but the Army wanted one such car for each division. Nor was it possible to provide visiting KDF groups with enough transport, accommodation, and performance space. More generally, given the restrictions under which KDF groups had to operate, the Army wanted to enable its troops to provide more of their own entertainment. In every regiment, certainly in every division, there are numerous soldiers with particular gifts and training in music, drama, art, recitations, etc. It called for one soldier in every unit to be appointed as a sort of entertainments manager, with a brief, among other things, to set up a soldier's choir, an instrumental group, and if possible, a theatre group. Yet Nazi ideology still tainted these more run-of-the-mill morale-boosting efforts. For instance, the intelligence section opined that kitting out accommodation rooms properly would not only keep the troops busy, but would also enable them to showcase their clean, tidy quarters to the locals, in comparison with the supposed chaos and filth of Bolshevism. From mid-November, Army Group Center's increasingly exhausted formations had scant time for such efforts. For it was then that they resumed their flagging advance on Moscow for the last time. It only really got going again because General Halder, believing that the Soviets finally had been smashed this time, pushed for the attack. This judgment, like many of the OKHs before, was based on poor intelligence that underestimated Russian numbers. The Germans were really only able to move at all because the ground froze in early November. General Mudd has been relieved, announced Lieutenant Richard D. of the 7th Panzer Division in a letter of 12 November. We saw out the last big battle with him, and now we can travel over the meadows. Panzer Groups 3 and 4 advanced to the line of the Moscow-Volga Canal, and by 28 November the German units nearest Moscow were 56 kilometers, 35 miles, north of the Kremlin. But winter's arrival portended calamity. In the north, on 6 December, Corporal Werner F. described temperatures of minus 30 degrees, even in the sunshine, a barbaric cold. 39 Corps, to which the division was subordinated, issued OKH guidelines on how to avoid freezing. Leave no one behind on the march. Hay and straw on the floor of vehicles. No sitting in the snow. Hug comrades on top of trucks. Change places. Run around. Extensive footwear. Insoles, don't lace up too tightly, enclose feet in rags or newspaper. So confident of victory had OKH planners been that they had made no plans for providing winter clothing and antifreeze for mechanized vehicles. Supplies of all kinds were running chronically low. The German supply system was prioritizing guns and ammunition, but such now were the demands of the campaign that even these could not be provided in the quantities needed. By early November, the transport system in the German-occupied Soviet Union had reached the limits of its capacity, and 1 month later, 70% of German locomotives were out of action due to the cold. All this meant there could be no respite for the exhausted formations at the front. So severe were attrition rates among the Panzer divisions, for instance, that by 18 November, Panzer Group 2's strength was down to 150 tanks from a peak of around 1,000. These were among the reasons why, despite coming so close to Moscow, German frontline operations finally ground to a halt during the second half of November. Panzer Group 2 was supposed to be driving on the main rail hub south of Moscow, but much of its dwindling force was still tied up clearing the Vyazma-Bryansk pocket. Panzer Group 3 and the 9th Army needed to divert forces to link up with Army Group North, for it was now the Red Army that was attacking here, and the 16th Army formations facing it were blighted by mounting losses and dwindling supply. An even more ominous development unfolded on Army Group South's front, when Rostov became the first major Soviet city to be recaptured by the Red Army during the Eastern Campaign. As the army neared crisis point, generals in the field did not rise to the occasion and pull together. Instead, they further betrayed their immediate concerns and their disregard for the bigger picture and fell out even more loudly than before. In Army Group Center, Panzer generals like Guderian continued to blame infantry generals like Kluger for making timid, sluggish progress. One thing Army Group Center generals did agree on was that their colleagues in Army Groups North and South were letting them down by not supporting the drive on Moscow. Colonel General Adolf Strauss, commander of the 9th Army, also accused Field Marshal von Bock of unclear leadership, and Strauss had a point, for although Bock was pushing on towards Moscow, he also feared that pushing on would lead to a soulless front clash with an enemy who, it seems, commands inexhaustible reserves of men and material. It must not come to a second Verdun. Bock was also aware how little time was left before the matter would be decided, either one way or the other. On 23 November, he declared to the OKH, "The clock stands at 5 to 12." General Halder ordered Army Group Center on, mindful of Germany's defeat in France on the River Marne in 1914, a setback that had ended its offensive in the west and heralded the onset of trench warfare. Halder now urged a decisive battle where the last battalion to be thrown in settles it. But Halder was driving the troops on in the face of stiff Soviet resistance, dwindling supply and rapidly worsening winter conditions, at a time when it was increasingly apparent that the Red Army was massing powerful forces for a counterattack. Halder himself blamed Field Marshal von Brauchitsch for the mounting difficulties. In view of the Field Marshal's less than sturdy support over Halder's strategic objectives, the general's frustration was at least partly understandable. But Halder was ignoring his own myopic fixation with the Soviet capital and the practical obstacles he had for so long disregarded. Similarly, despite German military intelligence's admittedly lackluster performance, The blame he heaped upon its failure to assess the Red Army opponent was not entirely justified. Halder was ignoring the real practical burdens intelligence was now laboring under. The Luftwaffe, which already lacked sufficient reconnaissance aircraft, was becoming too overstretched to provide any useful intelligence, particularly now that it faced increasingly effective Soviet air defense. Moreover, the dictates of immediate necessity were sending many army intelligence officers to the front, or to operations and quartermaster's sections. Even Guderian concluded, on 20 November, that Panzer Group 2 was too weak to reach Moscow. For so long one of the most cocksure German commanders, he became one of the most despondent as he withdrew his spearheads into defensive positions on 6 December. By now, in fact, all three of the panzer groups advancing on Moscow had been battered to a standstill by ferocious Soviet resistance and the still more ferocious winter weather, though, of course, the Germans were only caught by the weather because they had failed to reach Moscow sooner. The Germans' final drive on Moscow had failed, though it is unclear how much good it would have done them had they reached the city. Moscow's fall would probably not have been fatal to the Soviet effort on its own. Its loss as a major transport and administration hub would certainly have caused disruption, but the Soviet administration would still have functioned, and so too would the arms factories beyond the Urals. And the Red Army, with its rail network intact, would probably have had little difficulty in establishing a new defense line further east. However, Stalin and the Stavka were still terrified about the possible consequences if the Germans reached Moscow. It was this that lay behind their constant efforts to counterattack and the immensely high losses they were prepared to endure. General Konstantin Rokossovsky, commanding the Soviet 16th Army on the direct route to Moscow, commented after the war, "The army's defenses were spread so thin that they threatened to burst. It took feats of troop juggling to prevent this from happening." But it was the thinning of the front line, however perilous an undertaking it might be, that was enabling the Red Army both to draw in the Germans further and to amass the reserves that now stood ready to counterattack. Unlike previous Red Army counterattacks, this one would face utterly depleted German forces. By now, nearly a quarter of the German force that had invaded the Soviet Union on 22 June were casualties in one way or another. On that date, the German army in the east, or Ostheer, and its European allies had outnumbered the Red Army in the Western Military District by about 1.4 to 1. By 1 December, the Red Army outnumbered its opponents by 1.23 to 1. The historian David Stahel has coined the term National Socialist Military Thinking to describe a mentality that, aping that of Hitler himself, believed that sheer willpower could overcome concrete military and material obstacles. This, according to Stahel, helps explain why the generals failed to halt their offensive against Moscow and dig in on the defensive sooner. By 5 December, the day the Red Army finally counterattacked before Moscow, the generals no longer had a measurable military objective in mind. Attacking for its own sake was the objective now. And although several generals, including Bock and Guderian, had increasingly grave doubts about the wisdom of continuing the offensive, they fully committed their forces to it. That same day, the Soviet counterattack before Moscow began to unfold, with the main initial effort by four armies of the Western Army Group. Although both sides were suffering from the weather, the Red Army had a fully working railway system behind its lines. In most sectors, the Germans resisted fiercely, but it was not long before the Red Army, on Stalin's orders, was increasing the scale of its offensive, eventually to encompass over 1 million men in front of Moscow, together with numerous subsidiary offensives elsewhere along the Eastern Front. Over the following weeks, Army Group Center was pushed back over 200 kilometers, 125 miles, in places. Now it was the Germans' turn to practice scorched earth, as they sought desperately to stem the Soviet advance. The German offensive against Moscow had already been halted before 5 December. With it had come the Wehrmacht's first failed campaign of the entire war. The Soviet counterattack emphatically underlined that failure. The so often woeful performance of the Red Army between August and November 1941 was caused by the same failings that had beset it during the summer. Above all, the Soviet leadership's conduct of operations on the Southern Front and to an extent on the Central Front, remained lamentable compared with that of the Germans. All this fueled German hopes that the Red Army was indeed on the verge of collapse. But while the Germans themselves continued to show the same operational and tactical excellence as before, their overall progress was flagging. Many German generals began to doubt that they could finish off the Red Army before winter. Yet they pushed their troops on all the same. As they did so, the Soviet Union's size, resources, and environment played an ever greater role in slowing them and in grinding down their strength relative to the Red Army's. These problems might have been avoided, or at least reduced, had the German army leadership been far-sighted enough to organize its logistics much more thoroughly. The Red Army's defense, flawed as it was, proved resilient when it mattered most, and as it did so, sheer power of will, a central tenet of National Socialist military thinking, replaced sound operational practice as the main underpinning of the German general's conduct of the military campaign. More fundamentally, the flawed conception of the military campaign and the widening chasm between the Germans' means and what they were trying to achieve were the fault not just of Hitler, but also of the OKH and of Halder in particular. In the face of looming strategic disaster, the German army's anti-Bolshevism, anti-Semitism, and anti-Slavism increasingly came to the fore. The criminal orders had already extolled them. Now the increasingly arduous course of the campaign intensified them and helped to ensure that front-line formations reacted to the mounting pressures they faced in an ever more ruthless fashion. Moreover, as the fighting at the front dragged on, the occupied areas saw a decline in social and economic order and the first increase in partisan resistance. The Germans' now increasingly brutal and rapacious occupation policies both caused this state of affairs and were in turn exacerbated by it. Not all rear area units comported themselves with uniform harshness, but the ruthless trend was unmistakable. This was also part of the backdrop to the spiraling murder of Soviet Jews by the SS, an undertaking that would have been impossible without army backup. It was an undertaking to which commanders gave their support partly because they believed in the Jew-Bolshevik equation. But although this was an essential precondition of their cooperation, what made them prepared to go the extra distance to assist and sometimes perpetrate mass murder was their brutally warped, increasingly desperate perception of what was needed to keep the occupied rear pacified and their men supplied. Moreover, whether against Jews or any other wellspring of resistance, real, potential, or imagined, the combined influence of National Socialist charismatic leadership and the army's own Auftragstaktik created an attitude that equated ruthlessness with resourcefulness and initiative. The conservative attitudes of many senior commanders at the front and in the rear proved of little or no hindrance to the army's increasingly brutal conduct. Indeed, the fact that conservative-minded officers had themselves long held Jews and Slavs in a measure of contempt and positively abhorred Bolshevism and irregular warfare made the worsening conditions of the Eastern campaign even more likely to radicalize them. The ongoing ferocity of the fighting in the East and the mounting frustration army commanders felt at their continued failure to defeat the Red Army decisively hardened their conduct even further, and drove them to exhort their men to conduct themselves in a similarly harsh fashion. If German army units had not always been true to the spirit or letter of the criminal orders earlier in the campaign, then this was now changing. As for the troops themselves, where they hailed from and how old they were just two of the forces that could still influence just how brutally or otherwise they reacted to their situation. Indeed, the fact that senior field commanders saw fit to issue ideologically priming orders during the autumn of 1941 shows that they themselves recognized that their troops did not uniformly adhere to the ruthless dictums of Germany's war in the East. Nevertheless, the troops had been subjected to extensive, if varying, degrees of military and ideological conditioning before the campaign. Now the ever more desperate, overexerted troops at the front and in the rear were facing conditions that, combined with their conditioning, were to brutalize them increasingly. Chapter 10. Resistance and Reaction, 1941. Western Europe and Southeast Europe. During the second half of 1941, the ripple effects of the invasion of the Soviet Union spread through occupied Europe. Across the continent, communist movements had been very quiet since the signing of the Nazi-Soviet Pact. But after 3 July, when Stalin called for communists across Europe to take up arms against the Axis occupier, they took their place at the forefront of efforts to galvanize resistance. They did not succeed. Although resistance did increase in parts of occupied Europe, it was still too haphazard and piecemeal, still too lacking in popular support to have any long-term effect. But it did sow some of the seeds of the growing resistance the Germans faced from 1942 onwards. And it already had one dramatic effect in 1941. Where resistance was on the rise, the German army retaliated by hardening its security policy. Its reprisals also targeted Jews. In this respect, particularly, what happened in the occupied territories was also shaped by increasingly brutal impulses emanating from Berlin. In Western European countries where resistance threatened, the Germans had to ease the burden on their own overstretched security forces by relying extensively upon local police and collaborationist forces. They even had to rely upon ordinary inhabitants, whom they often made responsible for guarding rail and telephone lines. As resistance increased following Operation Barbarossa, military administrations that had hitherto countered resistance with restraint now started to retaliate more ruthlessly, whether against actual resistance or against the Jewish agitators supposedly orchestrating it. The military government in Brussels had Jews in its sights within weeks of the invasion of the Soviet Union, as it sought to close the gap between its anti-Semitic measures and those of the military government in Paris. This was regardless of the fact that Belgium's Jewish population was so proportionally small. Despite their relatively small significance, reported Raeder's administrative department in July 1941, a systematic proceeding against the Jews was necessary in order to come into line with how they are handled in other areas occupied or influenced by Germany. To this end, Jewries' participation in the economy was registered with numerical precision, and Jews were excluded from all public offices and positions. Jews and their economic concerns were systematically registered, and German administrators were placed in charge of those Jewish businesses where the Germans had a particular interest. Moreover, German civilian and police agencies did all the paperwork themselves. For, according to Raeder, the Belgian authorities cannot be expected to work loyally on this. The military government thus employed its own agency, a Treuhandgesellschaft, to do the job instead. In November 1941, the military government established an association of Belgian Jews in order to help promote and facilitate Jewish emigration, a euphemism for deportation to the East. The military government also vociferously targeted communists in the wake of Barbarossa. In October 1941, General von Falkenhausen announced that if culprits for a resistance act could not be found among non-communist circles, then communists themselves should be used as reprisal victims. He justified this measure, just as military colleagues in the East were justifying it, with the claim that communists were the intellectual originators of resistance. He charged the Brussels branch of the Security Police and SD with the task of carrying out the reprisals. The hardening ripple effects of the invasion of the Soviet Union were especially clear in the case of the military government in Paris. The military government had hitherto decreed that only regional commanders could seize hostages and order actual executions, and that they must consider alternative penalties first. Hostages taken as insurance should only be shot for acts committed after they had been seized, and then by order of General von Stülpnagel himself. The executions then had to be explained to the general public so that it fully understood the consequences of hostile acts. But there was one important respect in which these regulations and their follow-up regulations issued in March 1941 already suggested the harsher hostage policy that the military government would enact later in 1941. They stressed the principle of collective responsibility. In other words, the Germans would respond to hostile acts by collectively punishing communities rather than diligently seeking out actual culprits. From the autumn of 1941, the SOE and Charles de Gaulle's London-based Free French were steadily infiltrating agents and making contact with the resistance in France itself. Yet this kind of resistance, dependent as it was on still patchy Allied support, was slow to develop. The more dramatic development in occupied France during the second half of 1941 was the sudden spike in acts of sabotage and assassination committed by French communists from July onwards. The military government did not harden its security policy straight away. Between late August and early September, three German military personnel were killed in separate attacks. Hitler urged a ruthless response, but Otto von Stülpnagel ordered the shooting of 10 people, far fewer than Hitler wanted to see executed. Stülpnagel also selected the victims from the pool of prisoners already convicted for some other activity by a military court. Then came the OKW directive of 16 September, decreeing that 100 hostages were to be shot for every German killed. Even now, Stülpnagel tried to keep hostage executions to a minimum. He maintained, correctly, that limiting the number of executions was encouraging the French authorities to cooperate, because it was all that was needed to remind them of the consequences of not cooperating. To the OKH, he was more forthright still, declaring that he was finding the situation unbearable. He also told the OKH that hostage shootings on the scale envisaged by the 16 September directive made no political sense and ran counter to the guidelines that had been issued around the time of the 1940 armistice. Temporarily, Stülpnagel was able to get away with this line because both Hitler and the OKH were so focused on Operation Typhoon. Then the communists escalated their attacks again. Unteroffizier Arnold N., working in the military government's offices in Paris, reflected on the change in the air as fear increasingly plagued German soldiers, and the military government sought to restrict their contact with French civilians. "The soldiers' cafes now play a much bigger role than in the summer. We meet there and chat in our free time. In general, we are increasingly detaching ourselves from the population. We can go days without speaking a word of French. Yesterday I was with two old comrades in the court of Montmartre, although the commandantur had advised German soldiers not to go there due to the assassinations." In late October, Stülpnagel again pleaded that shooting hostages only damaged collaboration, and that more effort should go into finding the actual culprits. "I personally have warned against Polish methods in France," he stressed. However, with great reluctance, Stülpnagel now finally ordered the execution of a total of 200 hostages across two cities, Nantes and Bordeaux. Even this was milder than the scale of executions and financial penalties that Hitler was ordering. Nevertheless, Stülpnagel was finally escalating reprisal policy. On 23 October, Arnold N. wrote, "In recent days there was another murder, this time in Nantes, Feldkommandant himself." This was the relatively easygoing Lieutenant Colonel Hotz. "Unconscionable murderers, communists, possibly even enemy agents. The reprisals are awful as well. 50 French hostages have been shot, and now, at midnight, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes before another 50 are shot, if the murderers of the German Lieutenant Colonel from Nantes are not found. Dread is seeping through the French people, and I just heard that an officer has been murdered in Bordeaux. Will 20 people die for this, or will the number be raised again? Here, mercy is seen as weakness." By 24 October, the first two batches of 50 hostages had been shot. There followed a chaotic few days, filled by appeals from the Vichy government for the French population to cooperate with the Germans, a pledge from Pétain to have himself taken hostage in place of the remaining 100 existing hostages, De Gaulle's appeal to his followers, such as they were, to stand down from further attacks, and Germans' fears for how the executions were playing in neutral countries. Amid all the confusion, Stülpnagel was able to buy time for an investigation that actually succeeded in arresting a culprit in Nantes. Hitler then suspended the execution of the remaining 100 hostages. Then came yet another fresh wave of communist guerrilla actions. Most prominently, three German soldiers were blown up as they emerged from the Hôtel de Media in Paris in November, and the following month a Luftwaffe major was assassinated. Stülpnagel now faced renewed pressure to adopt a much harsher line from several directions at once, including the OKH, Göring, and Best, the head of the administrative subsection within the military government. Pressure also came from new regulations emanating from Berlin. That same month, December 1941, Hitler instructed the OKW to subject the Western European territories, save Denmark, to the Night and Fog Decree. This new measure made it possible for foreign nationals to be spirited away and put on trial in Germany, or simply handed over to the Gestapo and sent on to a concentration camp. The OKW maximized the fear factor surrounding the decree by imposing a blackout of any information concerning individuals who had been seized. A grisly example of what the Night and Fog Decree meant for its victims was the fate of 11 men and 6 women from the southern French resistance group Comba. The men were beheaded by the axe.